Yes, of course. Burl Baron. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming, streamlined studios of Outlaw Radio USA, nestled in our secret bunker, somewhere in the Los Angeles area. I don't know where we are. I'm lost. I'm dazed. I'm confused. I am the legendary Burl Bear.
Yes, you are.
Program produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. Howard Fetus, manager to the star.
And that I am too.
Yes. Mark C.G. Boyer, our fact checker. And we got some hot fantasies about nurses.
Oh, come on now.
I always ask the nurse, what are you wearing?
How do you go there with this story?
What do you mean, how do I go there? You have hot fantasies about... You don't want to have a hot fantasy about this nurse.
No, I don't think you do. No.
Peter Elkind. Peter, great to have you here.
Good to be with you.
I'll tell you, you've been a busy, busy man. Not only having this great book come out again, which we're thrilled and excited about, but also you're getting a lot of hot press on your CNN thing on The Man in the Machine by Steve Jobs.
I am. I'm out with Alex Gibney.
Yeah, the hardest working man in show business.
Yeah,
but that's a good thing. We'll get to all that in just a little while. First of all, you do know what you're getting into here, right?
Not entirely, but I'm wary now. You give me warning.
Okay, you have been warned, Peter.
This is not your typical true crime radio program.
It is the number one.
Mark is right. It is the number one. I don't know if you know this, Peter. The number one true crime radio program in the world.
Best podcast ever.
Yes. That too. And also, I want to thank our friends at Guinness World Book of Records.
Well, I'm honored to be on there.
And they track tapes. They have those out too. We do sometimes...
Why does that embarrass you, Burl?
What?
The fact that we are number one.
Well, it doesn't embarrass me. Dan Zupansky, by the way, who's going to be a guest on our show very soon, I thought.
See if he gets past me.
Dan also does a great show out of Canada.
Yes, he does.
I'm going to be on his show, and he's going to be on our show here very soon.
Well, apparently I'm not going to be on his show.
No, we couldn't find a reason to have you on.
Well, I sure have a reason to have him here.
Peter, let's get down to the real nitty-gritty.
You kind of get what this is all about. Now, what we won't do is make fun of the case.
No.
Because it's the furthest possible thing.
What I would say is that what we're in for here, Peter, is I think the phrase is a purposeful broadcasting misadventure.
Well, there's that. But
now, there's a reason I mentioned that. This lovely woman we're going to talk about today, and you'll give us the backstory. I understand that after she bumped off at least one person, if not more, she was removed from her position due to a purposeful nursing misadventure.
Bro, before we do that, and sorry, Peter, we're not bumping off people, we're bumping off babies.
Well, they're people. Yeah. She wasn't bumping off corporations, and they're people too, my friend.
Right, and I've read about them these days, but yes, absolutely.
So give us the backstory, Peter. Tell us about this woman.
Sure. This is the story of Nurse Janine Jones, who was a woman who worked in the pediatric intensive care unit at the county hospital in San Antonio, Texas. And so she had very sick kids under her care, and she arrived at the county hospital after several stints at other hospitals where she had shown good technical nursing skill but gotten in trouble for overstepping her bounds, making mistakes, doing bizarre things, and she'd gotten fired from a couple of places before she even got to this county hospital in San Antonio. Then when she arrived there, she worked the 3-to-11 shift, and after a time, there was a chilling pattern that developed where kids under her care would get sick and die. With much greater frequency than they did under any other nurse. They'd be fine on the 11 to 3 shift. They'd be fine in the other shifts, the day shift. And then when Nurse Janine Jones would come on, they'd have medical emergencies and sometimes die.
That's not good.
No. And, this nurse was not your fantasy. She was your nightmare.
Were the deaths similar?
Yes. Well, they were not. In San Antonio, they weren't completely similar, but there was a pattern of kids having sudden disease after they seemed like they were getting better or they were stable. And one of the there were several different symptoms they had, but one problem they had was they were having sudden bleeding problems, which led to suspicion that she was giving them excessive amounts of heparin, which is the blood thinner. And in fact, there was one episode where doctors were so suspicious of heparin overdoses that they literally had discontinued from the child. Had the drug discontinued. The child shouldn't have been getting any heparin. And then they had it removed entirely from the child's room. And then, nonetheless, the child started bleeding again.
Weird.
And bleeding from all of his pores out of his mouth. Rectum, horrible, uncontrollable bleeding. And the doctor realized this child was about to die. And so he took really an extraordinary measure, which is he gave the child a direct antidote. Drug antidote to heparin called protamine, and gave a dose of that, and the bleeding continued. Gave a second dose of that, and the bleeding continued. And finally, gave a third dose, and the bleeding stopped. This is solid proof as you could have that this child had been given an overdose of heparin when it wasn't supposed to have gotten any.
Well, how did they follow up on this? Like, how the hell did the kid get it?
They had an association between Jones and the heparin overdoses, but they never saw her specifically giving her an injection that they knew was heparin. So they had trouble connecting all the dots, but they certainly had plenty of evidence in that case and in others to have called in the authorities and done a real investigation.
Did they?
No, they didn't. Instead, and this went on for a period of months, actually more than a year, there was such a strong pattern that nurses and doctors were going to their higher-ups, to their bosses, and saying, we think she's killing kids. One of the nurses went to the charge nurse of the intensive care unit with a list of children who had emergencies or died under Janine's care. And it was that explicit that people were pointing fingers at her. And instead of calling the authorities, they kept it all very quiet and did an internal investigation with outside doctors. And finally, when they recognized they couldn't completely rule out Janine Jones, and they sure couldn't rule out Janine Jones, the contrary, they upgraded the intensive care unit as a way to get rid of her. Mm. She was a licensed vocational nurse, and they changed it from LVNs and RNs to all RNs, and that was an excuse to fire her, as well as four other nurses who had done nothing wrong.
But Peter, sorry to interrupt.
This is Howard has a question here.
Sure.
But we have kids dying. The hospital knows it.
Yes.
They don't report it to any authorities. They're going to take internal matters unto themselves.
Yes.
Which were pretty weak.
Yes.
Nobody accountable here?
Well, ultimately, no. And the bottom line, and the book traces, of course, all of this, is that she was sent off with a good recommendation.
Jeez.
Along with these other LVNs as a way to wash their hands of her. But they did not want to have a criminal investigation because they were concerned about lawsuits and scandal, and they were trying to upgrade.
How are they sleeping at night? How does that work out for them?
How do they what?
How do they sleep at night?
Well, good question. Good question. And when this all came to light finally, because she went off and harmed other kids and killed a child in the hill country of Texas named Chelsea McClung, a little 15-month-old girl, and that's a horrific piece of the story unto itself. But when that happened, and finally it became known, the prosecutor in San Antonio seriously considers indicting the hospital district.
Hell yes.
And its officials, and ultimately chose not to do that. So there was the investigator on the case for the DA recommended that be done, but the DA made a call not to do so.
You know what this reminds me of? I watched the movie Spotlight the other night. Where the incidents of the priests doing sexual things, and they just move them on to another parish or something, give them a break, a vacation, no one do anything about it, covering it up because they don't want the bad publicity.
Exactly, and that's what's really truly horrific about this case. I mean, you have crazy people doing horrible things. I mean, pathological nurses, murderers, serial killers. That happens. It's horrible. But then to have people who know better, who should handle it a different way, who are in a position to stop this from going on, and don't do so, that's what's really, really.
Are they not just as guilty?
Well,
You know, if you see somebody shoot your neighbor and you don't report
it. Yes. I think you share responsibility.
There's culpability, even if there's not.
But now you're in a position of administration of a hospital.
Yes.
And you do nothing, you hide it.
Yes.
Is that not accessory to murder?
They didn't feel like they could bring a criminal charge, didn't choose to bring a criminal charge.
Why?
But I think they felt they prevailed on the DA. There's a lot of political pressure, but they prevailed on the DA that this would be terrible for the community.
It would make people look bad.
Oh, I see. So it's better we have dead kids. That's not so bad.
Well, this is.
And by the way, Peter, I'm not going after you. Trust me.
No. I understand. You're asking exactly the right questions. But after this has all happened and the kids are dead and she's behind bars, the question is, you know, what do you do about it in terms of assessing blame and responsibility? One thing they did do is they made sure that the entire hierarchy of the hospital. You know, everybody who was in line to have done something and who failed to do something was removed. And the new administrator who took over fired all of those people. It's kind of a closet agreement, as I describe in the book, to get rid of them. But nobody was charged criminally.
You've almost got me going where I don't want to quite go yet, but I have to. I want to fast forward ahead. Because she was charged, and correct me if I'm wrong, with two, correct? One and two.
She was charged with one murder she was charged with injury to a child in San Antonio, no murder case.
Okay.
Even though she was believed to have murdered kids in San Antonio.
Okay.
And so then she was charged and convicted of murder in Kerrville, which is a small Texas hill country town where she went to work in a pediatric clinic.
All right, so she gets two consecutive sentences, one for... and again, help me out here. One for
sure.
and 90 years and one for 60 years.
One was not 99 years for murder and 60 years for injury to a child. And they were concurrent to run concurrently.
Right. Okay. So off she goes to see the wizard, and that's the end of her. Until we find out that there's a little known law, or that we certainly don't know about, but I guess they know about it in Texas, that says that. Shucks, somewhere around the year 2017, we got to clean these places out. We're overcrowded. We know the jails are going to be overcrowded, so we have to start letting some folks out. And sure enough, our friend, our little heroine here, is in line to be released in 2017.
Not a good thing. Yes. I think it's actually early 2018, but that's exactly right. And it's not discretionary at that point, as I understand it. It's mandatory release in early 2018.
So out she goes. It's out she goes. And
yes.
And now
I don't think anybody's going to hire her.
Well, there you go, bro. Maybe we'll get her as a co-host on the radio show. All right. So here's the deal.
Yes.
From what I understand here, there's a group that just can't stand for this, especially some of the parents of some of the children that are gone, and they don't want to see her on the street by any stretch of the imagination. So there is a race on to find more victims of this. I don't know what to call her.
Woman.
By bitch from
hell.
Yeah,
good. Yeah, that's it. Why don't you be politically correct? I'm going to use another word, but maybe not today, okay? So this person is going to get out unless they're able to find and prove that she did other murders.
Correct. That's exactly right.
And they're racing to try and get that done.
Yes.
Was it Andy Cahan working on that?
Yep.
Exactly right. Exactly right. He's a victim rights coordinator in Houston.
Right. We've had him on the show. Yeah.
And he's got involved in this because he's been there and done this before. There was another killer who was preparing to be released, and he helped bring pressure which resulted in a conviction that kept him behind bars until he died in prison. And so he's trying to do the same thing here, and there's a group, a Facebook group that's been started. There's a petition that's been launched, and it's resulted in a lot of pressure, growing pressure, on prosecutors to try to do something to keep her behind bars, but it's really hard to think how that can happen. They're doing what they can, and their sentiments are completely understandable. And one of the group members of the group, by the way, is Petty McClellan, who's the the mom of the child's 15-month-old little girl, beautiful little girl, who Jeanine Jones murdered. And she's very actively involved in this.
Now, I want to kind of dial back here a little bit, because this is such a horrific case and so fascinating, and you've written a complete book on it that's rather well-known, and it's in his back again, Death Shift. Am I correct, the title?
Yes, exactly right. And we publish it as an e-book beginning on Tuesday.
Oh, perfect timing.
Yeah.
People, that one, it's going to do well for you, not well for her. Must be heartbreaking for the families to go through this all over again. Now, what I find fascinating, aside from the horrific nature of the case, is this woman. I mean, she, what do you call this? Like Munchausen syndrome by proxy. What was she getting out of this?
Yes. There's a syndrome that I believe she fit, where she fits the pattern very, very well, where people who get a thrill, get some sort of strange kick out of having medical procedures done to them, which is called Munchausen syndrome. They like the thrill and the excitement of being the focus of attention in a hospital. And they'll show up in a hospital time and time again with symptoms that seem to have no cause or even seem to be made up, where they have burns that they've inflicted on themselves or injuries they've inflicted on themselves to make it seem as though they're suffering from some terrible illness, so they'll be subject to medical tests and treatment, and they're repeat visitors into the hospital and emergency rooms. That's Munchausen syndrome. And then there's Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which I think is what went on with Jeanine Jones, where she liked to be in the center of attention and consequently cause medical illnesses for her patients. So there'd frequently be codes where you have to resuscitate a child, which is kind of an incredibly dramatic, climactic moment in a hospital. Life and death is at stake. And she was always in the center of it doing CPR.
Oh,
and there's this very recurrent pattern that kids under her care would have codes at extremely high rates. They were far more likely to have codes under her care, 25 times as likely to have an emergency.
So she was looking to be the hero who missed a whole lot of times.
Yes. And sometimes she saved them, sometimes they lived, and sometimes they didn't.
Jeez. Now, in this investigation, in the trials, lawsuits, whatever, did she have anything to say about this? I mean, did she make any statements? Did she try to explain any of this?
She had plenty to say. It was really quite extraordinary. I interviewed myself several times.
Really? That must have been unnerving.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the most unnerving episode of that.
Please.
I originally wrote about her, started to report about her, when she was under suspicion of this. She was under investigation. She hadn't been charged with anything, so she was still free. And she was living in a trailer home in San Angelo, Texas, in rural West Texas, with another nurse who was very close to her and a couple of other women. And it's kind of a strange group, but I got in touch with her, and she agreed to see me. So I drove out to San Angelo, and I spent 6 hours in the trailer home talking to her.
Wow.
And my editor was quite nervous about my doing this. I mean, we agreed I would, but we had a special signal set up where he would contact me in the middle of the interview. I'd make a call. When we set up a code so I would let him know if there's any problem going on. And in this trailer home, you know, this nurse who had this pattern of people stopping breathing when she was around, and that continued in the hill country, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But in this trailer home, one of the women she was living with had a baby, and the baby had been taken to the hospital in San Angelo with a sudden emergency. Jeanine Jones had taken her in, claiming that she was the baby's grandmother, and the baby needed emergency medical treatment. So this was seemed to be continuing, the whole pattern, even while she was under suspicion for murder and under investigation.
What did you talk about for 6 hours, Peter?
We talked about everything. We talked about all the facts of the case and the allegations against her in both San Antonio and in Kerrville. And I went to in great detail what had happened in each episode, and she offered her own account of it. And she was adamant about everything. She hadn't harmed the kids. She was fighting for them. The doctors had screwed up. The other nurses had screwed up. Doctors were having, she dished dirt about people, saying they're having affairs with each other. She told all kinds of stories about alleging incompetence by everyone but her.
Of course.
And that she was battling for the kids. And what was really striking is, in her presence, she was so sure of herself, you know, that it's compelling. It's persuasive. I mean, I knew better, and I specifically knew that that factual things she was saying about the sequence of events, about what drugs were given, what drugs weren't given, you know, that were reflected in not only reporting I had done with many other sources like EMTs and other nurses, but also in factual documents, medical records, emergency ambulance reports, you know, that laid out details, they contradict her completely.
And yet she would just continue on with her BS, huh?
Now,
yes.
What did you learn about her as a human being? You were there for 6 hours in her house, in her home.
I realized that she really did. One, she thrived on the on all of this attention, as twisted as it was. Two, she didn't seem to. She seemed to be completely persuaded of her own innocence, and she was telling the tale in a compelling way, albeit, you know, factually wrong in many cases, and clearly wrong in the substance. You know, I was struck by the power of her personality, but I was also struck by how crazy she was, you know, the kind of incredible things she would say. And by the way, while I was there, she occasionally offered me something to eat or drink.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm well fed.
That was my reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, we're going to take a quick 60-second break to spike your punch. We'll be right back on True Crime Uncensored with Peter Elkin. Stand by.
This is Frank Hagan, the gay guy from Outlaw Radio. If you own a cell phone, and I know you do because you probably got Grindr on there, but it's time for you to add another app. That app would be for Outlaw Radio through the courtesy of RadioLoyalty.com. My suggestion is that you upload that app for free, mind you. Yes, totally free app. In order to be able to listen to us, the Demons of Decadence, every Saturday afternoon from 3 to 6 Pacific Standard Time or Pacific Daylight Time. And you'll have the opportunity to listen to us smoke, drink, and interrupt each other, which we do a really good job of doing. So once again, RadioLoyalty.com to pick up your free app of Outlaw Radio. Once again, this is Frank. So get off a Grindr and get on to Outlaw.
Nice. Hi, I am the legendary Burl Bear, host of True Crime Uncensored on OutlawRadioUSA.com. And when I'm not being brilliant on the radio, I am cranking out true crime, mysteries, popular culture, and all sorts of other things where I sit and stare at my word processor. Sometimes I actually write something, and then they publish it, those fools, and people buy it. Coming out, actually out right now, is my private eye novel, Headlock, where I get to be the hero. You see, I figured no one was going to write a private eye adventure with me being the hero unless I wrote it myself. So I did. And it's available right now. Now, coming out in about a month and a half is A Taste for Murder, a true crime story that I wrote with Frank C. Gerardo Jr. That'll be a one-hour TV special on Investigation Discovery. I believe that broadcast is March 13th. That's Taste for Murder coming out in March. And while you're at it, also pick up Serial Killer Quarterly, every serial killer's favorite quarterly magazine.
Back to True Crime Uncensored.
Yes, and well worth it, too. We have Peter Elkin, author of the classic true crime book that's being re-released called The Death Shift.
With Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus.
Oh, yeah, we weren't in The Death Shift, but we're on the radio. And we're very fortunate to have Peter on the show with us today.
Featuring Mark C.G. Boyer.
And Mark C.G. Boyer has a question for Peter.
Yeah, I know. So you're in the trailer. Where are her children at this point?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Where are her children when you're in?
Where are the children?
Yeah, her kids.
Oh, her kids. Oh. Her kids are grown. One of them, after she was sent away, they were Her sister took care of one of them, and her and the other went to Child Protective Services.
Now, when you were in the trailer, where were the kids? Did she have them with her?
Oh! Well, her for a lot. A strange thing is, if she had these two children, and for a lot of the time, her mother was taking care of them. She basically left them with her mom for the work shifts that she worked, and as well as when she was in San Angelo. As I recall, her kids were not with her. Her kids were not with her in San Angelo.
The curiosity I have is that all of these other people's children are coming down with mysterious, potentially fatal health risks, but I didn't find anything on her children having any issues.
Well, she actually brought one of her kids into the hospital with some frequency, with medical concerns, and she herself was seen repeatedly in the hospital with. Where she was reporting medical issues herself, and in fact she was in there so frequently, and this is documented in the book in great detail. She was in there so frequently that they recommended a psychiatric consult for her.
But that doesn't keep people from hiring her.
Well, that's correct. And by the way, when she went to San Antonio, she'd already been fired at a couple of places previously for insubordination and inappropriate actions.
But this is what amazes me. She doesn't have a great track record here as a healthcare professional. Why are people hiring her?
Well, first of all, there's a nursing shortage.
Yes.
Of course, there's no excuse, but so hospitals were...
So let's get the ones that kill people. Bring them on in.
That's like the New Orleans Police Department.
It's fortunate for the shortage of that type of nurse, yes, absolutely. But she had an ability to bring people. She was a very polarizing figure. Obviously, you know, there were a lot of people that literally said she's killing kids, and went to their supervisors and demanded, begged, pleaded that they do something. But there were others who were also kind of very impressed with the strength of her personality, her technical skills at starting an IV, and her kind of assurance about her medical knowledge. She was always sure of herself. She was, you know, sometimes wrong, but never in doubt.
And, yeah, she was right, even if she was dead right, or the patients were.
Yeah, but Peter, I can start an IV, and I've got a hell of a personality.
And people fell for that in some cases. I mean, she was technically a skillful nurse, and seemed to really know and care about what she was doing. But in fact, obviously, she was dangerous and didn't. But it left some people thinking she was a great nurse, the best nurse in the entire unit. And it left some people thinking she was killing kids. And so, in this case, in San Antonio, for example, the charge nurse fell into that category of people who thought she was really a good nurse, and was incredibly protective of her for a very long time. And despite her, Jeanine, doing things that were insubordinate to the charge nurse, to the head nurse in the unit. Hmm. And it's incredible that she allowed her to get away with the stuff. You know.
She must have had a very strong personality.
Yes.
That was able to bluff and bluster her way through this stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, she's going to do American Bandstand. She's really happening.
Yeah.
She was incredibly, incredibly strong personality and kind of steamrolled over a lot of people.
Now, what's the deal on her having a black book?
When she got in trouble and she thought she was going to get fired, and that when she knew there was an investigation underway that was targeting her, she threatened the hospital and said, "I've got a little black book with all the mistakes that doctors and nurses have made, doctors have made especially, and I'm going to make that public." She tried to play hardball in her own kind of twisted way, and she did stuff like that all the time. She threatened to reveal secrets about people, which...
Did any of that seemingly sit at the root of the cause of no problems coming to her from the hospital?
I don't think so. In a sense, well, it was a part of the problem. Good question. It was a part of the problem because they were afraid of her in some ways, because she was such a strong personality. They knew she'd push back very hard, and they felt like unless they had absolute rock solid proof, they'd be in a mess. And, you know, the reality is you've got to do things...
A mess in what way? I mean, this is a...
PR problems.
Hang on a second. Yeah. The backup guys, both, please. You've got a woman that's living in a trailer in the west of Texas, and or mm-hmm. wherever she was living. This is not somebody that had a lot of financial means. What is she going to do? Stand in front of the hospital and hope that the press gather? And we're not talking about a massive amount of press in San Antonio, Texas. You know, what do we've got? The three or four news TV newsrooms, a few radio guys, and a newspaper.
Well, that's a little further along in the story where she was, you know, under investigation and was marginalized in a much more substantial way. When she made the threat about the Black Book, and when she made various other threats to people to, you know, expose somebody having an affair or this or that, it was a different situation. It was earlier, and they feared her strong personality. That she'd badmouth them, she'd embarrass them.
Again, Peter, seriously, to who's going to buy it?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. And looking back, or even at the time, it makes zero sense. Let's see, we might get embarrassed. We have this nurse making accusations versus we have accusations that she's killing kids and we should call the DA.
I've had my day or two in PR. Give me about 10 minutes in this place and I'll figure it out for them. I mean, you've got a lunatic here.
You do have a lunatic here.
And they've got more proof than she does.
Yes, absolutely. But one of the things to know about this is, you know, this issue was discussed extensively at the highest levels of this hospital, county hospital, and the medical school. They conferred with the dean of the medical school, the administrator of the hospital. They called in their outside lawyer. And the argument, the conclusion they had was they should say nothing unless they had absolute proof. And, you know, proof doesn't occur.
In front of it. I mean, there's 16 different ways of doing this. They had no professional PR person there. You could have all the lawyers in the world and all the CEOs in the world. If they don't know what the hell they're doing, and they didn't, then here's what happened. More kids died, and they should be in jail.
I understand that point of view, and there are a lot of people that feel the same way.
Not a point of view. It's a fact. that just doesn't happen to be how I think. It happens to be what happened down there.
I understand.
Well, you know, Texas is also the place you're probably familiar with Stephen Long coverage of the one time in America where a corporation was actually put on trial for murder. Now it was in Texas, and it was
assisted living.
Yeah, where they were assisting him to die. And that was an actual case. The hospital won. Oh, yeah, the maggots are good for cleaning out the wounds.
The notion, you're right. You're right in the sense that the hospital bore responsibility for allowing her to do what she did. There's no question about it. They were partners in the crime.
So now we've got the gate being oiled for her to walk through it, okay, in a year or two. Our friend Andy rushing around trying to find a case against her, which is pretty difficult 20-some-odd years later. Is that all right?
Okay. Yeah, it's extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, it's almost virtually impossible because, you know, shucks, lots of things were destroyed.
Records were destroyed, and equally important, they tried really hard to get a murder case on her in San Antonio back then. And they called in the Centers for Disease Control and did a study of the emergencies and deaths in the ICU, and they concluded that basically there had been the equivalent of an epidemic there, and that she was the cause of the epidemic. She was the epidemic.
This is going to be a strange question for you, and I don't think that there's a right answer. It's probably a question I shouldn't be asking, but I'm going to
ask it.
I'm going to anyway.
You're going to ask it anyway, I think.
I'm going to. You know me. It's normally 40 minutes, but you get it.
It's enough. Yeah.
You try to think how to phrase it. Just be blunt.
If she walks, is she in danger?
Is she in danger herself?
Uh huh.
Now, could someone bump her off?
You got a lot of dead kids.
Yeah.
With a lot of siblings and a lot of parents probably still alive and a lot of maybe even grandparents still alive and a lot of neighbors and friends. And
yeah. The short answer is, I mean, it's possible stranger things have happened. I haven't heard anybody who's threatened her life.
No, because that would be stupid to do that.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
No, I'm just asking, and that's why I was.
I got a personal question I got to ask you.
This is Texas, of course. So.
I was in Texas where I interviewed Rhonda Glover, who was convicted of murdering her boyfriend, and I'm sitting and talking to her in the prison. There's glass between us and all. But when I came out of this, when I'm thinking about you being there at the trailer, when I came out of spending an hour or two with her, and I sat down and my daughter looked at me and said, "Dad, she's going to be in prison for 60-some years. She can't hurt you." But she could feel just the vibe off of me from spending that amount of time with a homicidal crazy person in prison. And I'm sure it must have affected you somehow emotionally, psychologically, to walk out of that trailer.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I was numb as I left. It was really an extraordinary experience. And by the way, I interviewed her again after in prison, and I described this in the book as well. After she was convicted, and she remained completely unrepentant, refused to acknowledge that she had done anything wrong. She had embraced the same position she had held throughout the entire controversy, the entire investigation, which is, you know, it was other people that had. She was fighting for the kids. She had saved lives. She hadn't killed anybody.
Now, was there any psychological or psychiatric tests done on her prior to the trial?
She had some psychological examinations when she was working at the hospital, but not in great detail. And she did not offer a insanity defense or anything like that. There was virtually no psychological testimony introduced at either one of her trials.
Anything at the sentencing hearing? Any mitigating circumstances like she's crazy?
Not really. No, there really wasn't. And by the way, one piece of this, one big part of this is, you know, we talked about how the hospital sent her off with a good recommendation. You know, that's when she went off to a pediatric clinic in Kerrville, a small hill country town. And she went to work for a pediatrician who had worked with her in San Antonio, but didn't believe any of the accusations about her and was very protective of Janine, a woman named Dr. Kathy Holland. And in this doctor's office, she opened up a new pediatric clinic, brand new doctor, opened up a pediatric clinic where kids came in with colds and sniffles and for shots. And in a period of a month, 8 kids had 9 separate emergencies and were rushed to the hospital. They stopped breathing. She was giving them a drug called succinylcholine, which leaves you paralyzed but unable to breathe.
How did she get a hold of that?
Because the doctor kept it in her office, which is very unusual for a pediatrician. She kept it in her office, she said, in order to help intubate kids who had emergencies, to help get a breathing tube down their throat so they wouldn't struggle against it.
It's an anesthesiologist.
In an operating room. It's very unusual that the doctor had it in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point.
And Janine was using this drug, and it's really just an amazing tale of what happened in Kerrville and how those guys finally, you know, brought an end to the whole thing. But ultimately, it was later discovered that the vial of this drug, succinylcholine, that Jeannie at one point said, I lost it, but I found the drug and showed it to the doctor. And the doctor later examined it after all hell broke loose. The doctor got suspended from the hospital. The investigation was underway. So the doctor finally went back and looked at the vial of the drug. And yes, it was full, but there were needle marks on the top. And it was sent for testing, which revealed that 5/6 of the contents of the drug of the vial were saline solution. So she had refilled the drug vial with water, basically.
It's kind of like kids used to do with their parents' liquor.
Yeah. Used to. Is that right? Was that a used to do?
They still do that?
I hadn't thought about that with my kids. I better watch out.
God, this is such a horrifying story. And, you know, and with other people who are nuts like she is or as she is, they think they're just fine. It's like they've got, you know, they say there's a, I don't know if you know the classic story of Gordon Alpert, I think, wrote about where the woman had the delusion that she was dead. That was her paranoid delusion. And the doctor said to her, "Tell me, do dead people bleed?" She says, "No, of course dead people don't bleed." He grabs her finger and pokes it with a pin, and she stares at the blood on the end of her finger and goes, "My God, I'm wrong. Dead people do bleed." That's a true story. And the moral of it being is that the brain will do whatever it takes to protect a delusion.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of revising her thinking, she'd embrace it in different thinking, yes.
Or as they say with conspiracy theories, if you disprove it, that just proves that it's true because you're in on it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way out of it for her. There's no way she's ever going to say, yes, I did that.
Yes.
Mr. Man. She does seem like Annie Wilkes in Misery.
Yeah, and there's some thoughts that she was the model for that character.
Yeah, because in that movie, that character has kind of that same sort of backstory.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Now, this phrase that I used at the beginning of the show, purposeful broadcasting misadventure, but she was written up for purposeful nursing misadventure. That has to be the most BS way of saying something I've ever read.
Well, there's an incredible amount of euphemism that was used to discuss in the corridors of the hospital and medical school what was going on. They were investigating it, and the euphemism, the language for what amounted to murder and suspicion of murder was extraordinary. When the hospital in San Antonio found out that she was being investigated for doing more stuff in Kerrville, for killing kids, for kids who stopped breathing and left the hospital, you know, they got together and discussed what to do about it, and they said, you know, we should, our response should be that we maintain, quote, a judicious silence.
Oh, that's, brother,
Jesus.
That's the language they used in actual hospital minutes.
I want to bitch slap all of them.
So you mentioned that while you were with the trailer.
So Mark Boyer has a question. Go ahead, Mark.
There were other instances while she was not working around the area.
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch that.
Well, okay, let me see if I'm getting this right here.
She's
not working, right, but she's living in the trailer.
You're interviewing her at the trailer. Well, while at this point in time, she's not actually nursing, but other children are still turning up ill.
Was she doing things to kids even when she wasn't working?
Well, she at the time when she was in San Angelo in the trailer, she certainly couldn't get a nursing job per se, but she, for a time, she was actually working in a senior citizen center, in a nursing home, not as a nurse but as an aide. So she's doing that for a period. But in the period when she was living in San Antonio, I'm sorry, in San Angelo in the trailer, she had a young woman who had a baby out of wedlock living with her, who she'd kind of taken in, and that child, as I mentioned before. Janine rushed her to the hospital saying that the child had stopped breathing. And there was another episode involving one of the other occupants of the trailer, the girl herself, who also went in sick. I mean, neither one of them died, but...
It's the same game.
It's hard not to view that as part of the same pattern.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way to me. Now, Mark, who's our researcher here and does a fine job, brought me in this suicide note. Janine wrote. Can you tell us what the backstory is on that?
Yeah, this is in Kerrville, and it's after there's been a series of emergencies where, again, kids walking into the pediatric clinic with colds or sniffle. I mean, routine doctor's office problems, walking into a pediatric ICU. Where they're really sick, but doctor's office problems where they have sniffles, or you know, you go in, you're gone, and you go home after 30 minutes, you get a shot or something. There were eight emergencies where kids were rushed into the ER in this little rural hospital, and finally, the doctors, you know, recognized something horrible was going on, and got, you know, and confronted the doctor about it. The doctor confronted Jones about it in her own way, and finally, they suspended Dr. Holland's privileges. Dr. Holland discovered the bottle of succinylcholine with needle marks in it, and Janine left for her this very dramatic suicide note, saying, "You know, all I ever did was try to fight for the kids." And she asserted that she had taken an overdose of pills. So she was rushed to the hospital in the middle of all this. All hell was breaking loose. She was in the hospital herself. and they pumped her stomach, and they later discovered that she had taken a number of pills that wouldn't have harmed her badly anyway. Yet another sort of
grab.
Another grab for attention and drama episode.
So if somebody wants to follow Andy's cases, did you mention earlier there's a Facebook page on this?
There's a Facebook page of people who are trying to keep her behind bars. Yes.
And, of course, his book, which is coming out or is out now, or you could get it. People could order your book right now, can't they?
It's going to be on Amazon and elsewhere, available as an ebook on Tuesday. I'm not sure if it's right there now, but I guess I should look it up and know that. But I think so.
Just in case you got some royalty checks coming.
Yeah.
The Death Shift is the title of the book, and I suggest you you read it because the story is absolutely.
There's so much more here, and we suggest you get the book. And I think we should move on with.
Yeah, I'm overwhelmed.
I've had enough of talking about this woman because.
I appreciate this, and I should tell you guys. I actually have not. I'm sorry to tell you this, but I haven't spent the rest of my career as a true crime writer. This is the first book I wrote. Actually, the first magazine article I wrote was about her. Kept me in journalism, and I went on, and I work at Fortune magazine these days, so I'm a business writer. I'm writing about a different kind of true crime frequently.
Well, there's that. That's kind of interested me about you, and maybe a sentence or two on a couple of things. Like for instance, if I were to say Steve Jobs' name,
yes.
Give us a few sentences on something that we may not have heard about him.
Sure. That he's obviously a genius, but he is also a torturous person to work for. I wrote a long story about him for Fortune, and one of the most extraordinary things I found out there was first that he denied paternity of his
of his
daughter, but didn't just deny paternity. He insisted he was infertile and incapable of having children, and he left the mom of his daughter to live on welfare while he was a multimillionaire. He obviously was not infertile. He went on and had several other children married.
What was that all about?
It was, extraordinary display of denial. He thought he could get away with it. It was bullying, which is something he engaged in a lot in his life. I mean, he did extraordinary things. He did extraordinarily egregious things and horrible things. In the film, it's now on CNN, which I helped with. I didn't make the film, but I participated in it. There's an extraordinary interview with a guy who worked on the Macintosh computer, who's in tears talking about Steve, about how it was the most incredible time of his work life, but it was also the most painful time of his life and cost him his marriage and his kids. And there's a lot of that about Steve Jobs.
I haven't seen The Man and the Machine, the thing you worked on, but I did watch last night the Michael Fassbender performance as Steve Jobs, and which is the whole thing centers around that denial of the paternity and his relationship with the daughter. And there's a scene in the film where she says, "Why? Why did you say I'm not your daughter? Why did you say I'm not, you're not my dad?" And he says, he says, "I'm damaged goods." I'm not well made. That's what he says. I'm not well made.
I found him to be interesting, and there is that dark side, that side of him.
Yeah.
Nolan Bushnell is a friend of mine, and Steve and Wozniak worked for Nolan at one point.
Atari, you mean?
What's that?
Atari.
Yeah, Atari, and Nolan invented Pong, which is a bizarre thing, and then he's a character. But they're all, a set of characters. But when Jobs' name came up in conversation with me, it was, let's talk about something else.
Yeah. There's a lot of pain. There's been a lot of pain there for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I found that to be very interesting. What about Elon Musk?
Elon Musk. I think he's fascinating. I think he's an extraordinary guy. I would love to have written a book about him if another good journalist hadn't beaten me to it. But he is he's done remarkable things. He's a great hypester, no question about it. Keeps himself front and center in the news always. I've ridden in one of his cars, and it's very cool, very amazing. I think it's going to be a really huge feat to try to duplicate what he's done, at $90,000, building that kind of car, and to build an electric car for the masses that'll work at $35,000.
Well, we're talking about the Tesla. Do you think that they're going to stay in business?
I hope they do. I think they will. I mean, they're not making money. They've lost a lot of money.
Right.
They've got they're investing huge amounts into what they're doing. They've got a lot of capital. I think there's a lot. You can go a long way on force of personality and relationships. He's a very wealthy guy. He's a very he's a hero to a lot of people. People like to invest with him. They like to finance what he's doing. He's definitely a visionary. But as a business, is this going to work? Especially if oil prices stay low, I don't know. It's really tough. I hope so. I think it'd be a great thing for the world if he makes a cheap electric car. I think it'd be fabulous.
Do you think that the corporate ownership of the dealerships is a model that will sustain, or does he have to franchise like the rest of the industry?
You know, I'm not an expert in the auto industry, but that's a really good question, because Tesla, as you know, and I think your question suggests, is trying to, they don't have dealerships. They're selling direct to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of states, Texas is top of the list, which refuse to allow direct sales, that require that you sell a car through a dealership.
Right.
Tesla's been trying to overturn those laws, especially in Texas, and in fact use that as a carrot. They use their giant battery factory, which Texas was trying to lure to the state as an economic development thing.
Mm-hmm.
as for jobs. He was suggesting that he would look more favorably on Texas as a site for his gigafactory if Texas would change the law that barred Tesla from selling directly to consumers.
So change the effing law. There's a lot of money to be made here. I've ridden in this car. It was a true joy beyond.
Consumer mm-hmm. Reports mm-hmm. rates it as the gives it the highest ratings of any car they've ever.
Well, you can't rate it any hotter.
We were going to have the Saint drive one in the new Saint TV series.
Well, there you go. I think, my goodness, this hour flew by.
Boy, it just really did. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the Sony hack.
Oh, there's
we'll
all
have you
all
back
of it.
About that one.
We're gonna have you back, and if you ever get to the West Coast, please come in and visit us.
Well,
Peter Elkin, Death Shift is the title of the book. Buy it, read it. Believe it. Good
hey,
luck
Bro.
To you, Peter. Have you out again soon.
Burl?
Yes.
What would be next?
Gee, it might be our close personal friend, Magic Matt Allen, a.k.a. Mr. Cigar, on Outlaw Radio USA, the land that time forgot.
Sounds of the horses, trumpets, and drums as they march through the country. How the good Lord's work is done. Oh, how the good Lord's work is done. How the good Lord's work is done.